You've just heard the first movement of a little-known work by John Cage entitled Dance Music for Alfred Ide, performed by Nexus Percussion, which is available on the Nexus CD number 10937. I'll be telling you more about this work later on in the program, but in the meantime, let me welcome this week's guests, two longtime Nexus members, Russell Hartenberger and Gary Kvistad, with whom I'll be speaking about their decades-long relationship with the music of John Cage. So welcome, Gary and Russell, to All Things Cage. It's a pleasure to have both of you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's just a sheer pleasure. You have been part of my life for probably, 40 years or so. And Russell, that pertains to you more. Russell joined Nexus in 1971. And right. Gary joined Nexus in 2002. Is that what you said? Yeah, 2002.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Gary, you've been in my life all the time you've been in Nexus. anyway, so I thought I'd start out by asking you both a question, which is something I really don't know the answer to it. And that is, I would be curious to hear from both of you on the question having to do with when Cage became an influence in your lives as percussionists. Was it when you were still studying? Wherever you were, I would just love to hear that. Russell, could you tackle that first?
Sure. Yeah, it's hard to remember one specific time when I became aware of Cage, because as a percussionist, we just sort of knew about him through his percussion writing for any time that we were aware of percussion ensemble music. I think the time that I really started becoming aware of him was in New York, when I started playing with the Steve Reich Ensemble in 1971. And Steve would do these premiere performances, or work in progress kind of performances, in lofts or art galleries in New York City. And of course, Steve wasn't known very much then. He was just sort of in the underground New York scene. And so the audience was primarily artists and other musicians and other composers. So John Cage was one of those people who came to some of those loft concerts of Steve Reich. And the first time I actually saw him and met him was in a loft, I can't remember which one, at a Steve Reich concert. But people were talking about him. He was already the seasoned veteran of the New York composition scene. So he was well known, and I was a bit starstruck, actually, even just to be around him when I first met him. But the first time I actually talked to him was on our first tour to Europe with Steve Reich in January of 1972, right after the premieres of Drumming. And I remember distinctly, we were in the Ratskeller of the Bremen Rathaus, or the City Hall of Bremen, getting ready for our concert at some kind of festival. And Cage was also performing at the festival. And we were in this restaurant, and I noticed Cage at another table, and he was having a good time with some of his friends. And then at one point he came over to our table, and I would happen to be sitting on the end of the table. And Cage said to me, "Are you an American?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Are you playing a concert tonight?" And I explained what we were doing, and he said, "I am too." It was great. It was a perfect Cage moment, just totally out of the blue, disconnected with anything that I had been thinking about at the time. Mm. So that was really a great moment. And then, of course, he came to our concert and we went to his concert. And that was sort of the beginning of my connection with him, anyway.
I see. I'm trying to think, 1972, I bet you went to a performance of one of his readings from Empty Words.
It was a reading. Uh-huh. It probably was right. It was a reading. I can't remember exactly, but I think you're probably right. Yeah.
Yeah. We'd get a lot of mileage out of those text pieces. He would write it, and then you would see, if you look in his chronology, you would see 22 performances that year. He would pick up his script, and go on the road.
Right. I can just add one more sort of story connection with that. This is maybe a couple of years later, when we were doing another loft concert for Steve's piece, Music for 18 Musicians, which probably was around, he premiered in 76. So this was either 75 or 76. And we did probably half the piece, or maybe we did the whole piece, I can't remember. But Cage came to the concert, and then I saw him walk up to Steve, and I was really curious as to what he was going to say. So I kind of sneaked over there to, so I could hear what he was saying. And the only thing Cage said was, "It changed." And I don't know what he meant by that, whether he meant that Steve's style changed from drumming in some of his earlier pieces, or whether there's a lot of harmonic change in the piece, or what it was exactly. But it was interesting that he just had those two words to say, and then he walked
away. How funny. And Gary, what about you?
Well, my introduction to Cage's music was through my teachers, Mike Ranta and Jack McKenzie, who were both part of the percussion department in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, when Cage was there. So, I was at the National Music Camp during the summer times up at Interlock, and Jack McKenzie was our teacher there. It had been the early 60s, actually. And we would play mores and some of the constructions and all that from that period on. And then I went to the Interlochen Arts Academy, where we had more intensive percussion ensemble. I was there year round. So we played a lot of Cage, and Ranta especially was a big advocate, and he had worked with Cage a lot. And then I went to the Oberlin Conservatory starting in 1967, and John was invited to be a guest speaker, but not at the conservatory, through the English department, of course. Right. And so I made sure that I was there, and we actually organized a performance of Imaginary Landscape number 4 for the 12 radio piece. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I controlled the channel, the tuner part of it. And Cage did the volume control. And I think there were 12 radios. So that's 24 players, right? And they're all mostly English majors.
Right, right.
It was fun. And John spoke beautifully for quite a while in a little English classroom. And then that was in this fall of 67. The next year, they started doing winter term projects, where you had 6 weeks off before the holidays and most of January to do whatever you wanted to. And I set my project to go to Champaign-Urbana and kind of hang out with all the new music people there, including Cage. He was in residence or something. I actually had a lesson with him, like an hour private lesson talking about percussion music. And I don't remember a thing other than the fact that I was also starstruck, and I'm sure that I was pretty nervous about that whole thing. But you know, he was my idol, my mentor, you know, knowing all that music. And of course, McKenzie and Ranta also turned me on to Lou Harrison's music and Harry Parch, which all three of those guys were a huge influence on my life and my musical thinking. And then I, my senior year at Oberlin, I was part of the senior honors recital, and it kind of in protest in a strange way, because everybody else was playing Rachmaninoff and, you know, like Beethoven on it, all the other players. I decided to do 4:33 on the senior honors recital in 1971 at Oberlin Music Conservatory. And it was in the concert hall in the music conservatory. And it was a long seat, very long rows. And everybody approached it from one side, and the other side were emergency exit doors. The hall was completely filled because it was graduation, right? And all the parents, it was half parents and half students in there. A cello player came out and played Dvorak. And then I came out and with my marimba and a stick tray. And the first movement, I did it with hard mallets, and I paused. The second movement, I did with four soft mallets. I set it down. And the third movement, I went back to a pair of hard mallets, just sort of like a marimba piece. And during the slow movement of 4:33, and there was a lot of rumbling, you know, because people just didn't know what to do or think. So that was obviously the ambient sound that we were looking for. But the highlight for me was that one parent freaked out, stood up and walked out, but unfortunately went toward the emergency doors instead of the normal exit, Turns out the emergency doors were all locked. So he was slamming on the door. It couldn't get out. And Ben had to walk in front of the stage to get out. And I just smiled at him and I said goodbye. And that was my performance. It was wonderful. But we played that so much. We did it as an encore in one of your concerts at Bard College, where we came out as an encore and did what we called an excerpt of 433 with masks of John Cage on, all six of us. That was fun.
And your blue jean jacket.
So, a lot of,
right.
And, oh, right.
You
yeah.
Wore blue jean jacket.
That's right. With blue jean jackets and blue jeans and a blue jean, blue shirt. So,
and your little Cage smiley face. People
yeah,
love
that. That was quite a program. We did Credo and Us, as I remember.
Yes.
And there were some great things on the radio at that time.
You did Third Construction.
Yeah.
Third Construction, of course. Third Construction has sort of become a piece for you guys, is it not? I always think of Third Construction as associated with you.
I think we were probably the first group that made it well-known in the percussion community anyway. Black Earth, actually, Gary's group, played it before we did. Isn't that right, Gary? I think you
kind of discovered it in 77. We worked on it for a whole month, did nothing else every day but rehearsed it. And then I think we took it to the Acoustic Society convention in State College, Teachers College, Pennsylvania, and played it there. And then we toured in Europe for 3 weeks playing it. And it was such a huge hit. You know, everybody loved that piece. I remember Laura telling us that when Nexus played it in LA at the Music Circus, was it? That Cage leaned over to you and said, "I guess this is my bolero piece."
Exactly. What had happened was we were both performing in the Music Circus. I was doing Maggiore Landscape, radio part, and he was doing, I don't remember, one of his text pieces. And I had a break. And so I came down and sat next to him, and we all had those little printout programs. You remember what Larry Stein made, these little programs that showed who was going where. And all of a sudden, half of the house got up and moved across the theater, the movie theater, which is what it was, an old movie theater. And I was sitting next to John, and I picked up my program, you know, to look. And I said, "Oh, this is your Third Construction?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "And that's Nexus over there?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "It's a popular piece." I didn't know. I mean, I was a new kid on the block in 87. And I said, "So this is a popular piece for you." And he just looked at me dead serious. And he said, "It's my bolero."
I like it a lot better than bolero myself.
It just eclipsed so much for him, that piece did, because it was so, as you say, so popular. People loved that work, you know, and that continues to this day. It's, you know, there's nothing not to love about that piece.
It became popular, but you know, the first time that we played it for Cage, I don't think he'd heard it in a long time, or maybe he hadn't heard it since his group played it in Cornish in Seattle.
Right. What's the date of that? It's like 38 or something.
I can't remember exactly. 42. Yeah.
42?
But
okay. Same as a little later than I thought, but 42. That would make sense.
Yeah. But Nexus played a concert in Toronto with, it was called Roratorio with the Chieftains, the Irish group, and some other people. And we played Third Construction, and we knew Cage was going to be there, of course. He was participating. So we played it for him before the concert, just so he could hear it. We wanted feedback on what he had to say. And,
of course.
And he didn't say much, of course, but he said, "You know, I didn't realize that it was so clear." Huh. And I'm not sure if that was a reflection on the comparison to the way his group played it and the way we did. I mean, we were obviously all trained percussionists and they weren't. So maybe that had something to do with it, or maybe our choice of instruments. But the only comment he made about our instrument selection was that one of the players was playing the cowbell part on Almglocken, which had resonance to it. And he said he didn't expect to hear so much resonance from the cowbells. Mm-hmm. He was expecting a more dead, normal cowbell, muffled cowbell sound. But that's really
so that
all.
Was his only comment, I think that was, he really loved it then.
He seemed to,
I had the feeling in that one exchange that I had with him in LA for that the music circus, that Nexus had put that work on the map, Third Construction, that Nexus had really been responsible for a kind of worldwide knowledge of that piece and added to that bolero sort of phenomenon that he was experiencing with that work.
That's probably true. You know, we played it quite early on at the Percussive Arts Society convention. That's, you know, so thousands of percussionists heard it. And I think it was probably the first time most of them had ever heard it or heard about it, except those who had been to a Black Earth concert.
Of course.
All 10 of them. Yes.
You had 10 or 10 concerts?
No, I'm joking.
Oh, how big was Black Earth? How many players?
It was a quartet most of the time and a trio at the very end.
And how long, what's the duration for the ensemble?
We lasted same as the Beatles, 7 years.
Did you have a Yoko Ono?
We probably did, and I don't remember. It was, the 70s.
It was the 70s, right?
I was just wondering, what broke you up?
Well, we went through a lot of personnel changes, actually. And two of us remained the whole time, Al Adi and myself. I told Al at the last year of the group, I said, you know, if the other person, Stacy Bowers, were to leave, I don't want to like keep finding new members and all that. So, and of course, Stacy decided he wanted to do something else. So we stopped. We spent one semester in Champaign-Urbana, where we got started. Tom Saiwi set us up there in residence. And then there was an opening at Northern Illinois University, which had an amazing percussion department with Al O'Connor and Don Buchla and Moog helped build an electronic music studio there, and just a phenomenal setup. A lot of percussion. Al had started a steel drum band there. So we were there for 5 years as a percussion department, and it helped kind of solidify our touring and all that. So we had like a place to come back to, and we were there for 5 years, and then 2 years at the College Conservatory of Music at the University of Cincinnati, which was a very straight ahead music conservatory, but they had some new music scene happening there as well. That was great, but you know, 2 years there, and then Diane and I decided to move to the Hudson Valley, where in the first year we were here, we saw John Cage and Merce Cunningham perform at the Woodstock Playhouse. So that would have been in the very early 80s. That was an unbelievable coincidence to catch that there.
The concert venue, which you now, for many, many years, have had an association with.
Well, the Playhouse is one institution, but I was involved with the Birdcliff, the Woodstock Birdcliff Guild, which was the initial, you know, organization, Birdcliff Colony, that's started in, I don't know, back in 03 or something like that, a couple of years after Harry Partch was born. And yeah, I was the chairman of the board there for many, many years, and did a lot of concerts. We call them the Woodstock Beat Concerts. We performed at Maverick. We did a lot of Cage music. 1 year, Stacy Bowers did Dream, of John's piano work, beautiful piece. Mm-hmm. Henry Cowell had lived here in Woodstock area, so we did some Cowell, and a lot of Harrison. And then Nexus came and did a lot of stuff. And then we started producing a festival called the Drum Boogie Festival.
Of course.
We did, didn't we do the Third Construction on that at one time?
We probably did, one of the early ones, yeah.
Somewhere, yeah. So. Yeah, Cage was a very important part of it, for sure.
What other pieces does Nexus do of Cage's on a kind of regular basis? I'm trying to think of what I've heard you do. I mean, City Wears a Slouch Hat, of course, which is so beautiful. So just a wonderful, wonderful recording.
We've done Credo in Us quite a bit.
Of course.
One piece we did for a while was Amores. Of course, we needed a piano player. There was one particularly memorable performance we did at the University of Toronto. The pianist was Marion Ross, who's a great pianist, did a lot of contemporary music. And Cage was there. And we played, the Amores is piano, then a drum movement, then a woodblock movement, and then another piano movement. And so the Marion played the piano movement, and then Bob Becker and Robin Engelman and I played the drum movement. And it just was, it was a great performance. It just like really took off and was really exciting. And the audience applauded after the drum movement. Mm. So Marion, the pianist, thought that we were finished with our whole part. So she started playing the last movement. And we were poised to play the woodblock movement and didn't know what to do. Should we tell her to stop? Should we just wait and play it afterwards? We stood there. And while we were standing there, John Cage walked down. He was in the very back of the auditorium. He walked down the stairs, walked onto the stage, walked over to Marion and said, "They're not finished yet." And then walked back. So she was embarrassed and stopped. And so we did the woodblock movement. It's a, you know, we had no idea, you know, he's this guy that's so open to chance, but yet when chance took over in that particular performance, he wanted it played like he wrote it.
He was particular, I think, as you've talked about, Russell, he was particular about performances of his work. He would, mm-hmm. he known him to get really upset when people don't take something seriously enough or take it too seriously. You know, so there was this little balance in the center of that, that he really expected and wanted from people. So
mm-hmm. I think you're right. Yeah.
So Black Earth. So Gary, so actually this is a question for both of you. Forgive my ignorance on this subject, but you know, I'm so enmeshed in Cage all the time. And I'm so well aware of the absolute dearth of percussion music when he was growing up. That, you know, that he was constantly commissioning it or just appealing to composers to write something for percussion. So you were both of a time where there was plenty to play. Is that true?
Not me.
You know, not really.
There wasn't very much.
So when do you think
I think Cage had a lot to do with it, with his constructions, even though they weren't really played till quite a number of years after he wrote them. Mm-hmm. Lou Harrison, I think, had a lot to do with it also,
right,
with his music. And then a lot of percussionists started writing their own music because there wasn't a lot to play. But I don't think it was really until Steve Reich started, you know, wrote drumming and some of his other early percussion pieces that a lot of other composers got interested in writing pieces for percussion, like, you know, real composers started writing for percussion as well. Uh-huh. But when I was a student, we played a lot of transcriptions of like marimba, you know, violin music on marimba. There just wasn't a whole lot to play.
Right.
I think Gary was a little bit after that. But
yeah. Sorry, I was just wondering if you, Russell, have ever made transcriptions yourself.
Yeah, I have a little bit, yeah.
Uh-huh. And Gary, have you? Have you ever done arrangement for percussion? Never? How come?
My brother is a percussionist, and he was the composer in the family. So I kind of shied away from that, but I wanted to say that, you know, I see Haydn's relationship to string quartets as Cage's relationship to percussion ensemble music. You know, I think Haydn kind of developed the string quartet, and even though there were people before Cage like Varese and Mio, mm-hmm. That wrote for percussion, Cage had a substantial repertoire that really turned a lot of us on, you know, and we were pretty young back then, already somehow in tune with that, really responded well to that as music. And I think it's in his Silence book where he says that the future of music is percussion. And I took that to heart, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah, I think one of the things that also helped with percussion music being composed or arranged was sort of awareness of world music in the 60s and 70s. A lot of us realized there were a lot of percussion traditions around the world and wanted to be more involved in playing music with just percussion instruments, and realized it could be done and wanted to do that. And Cage, of course, was very helpful. He was aware of a lot of these traditions too, and Harrison also.
Mm-hmm. I thought of Harrison the minute you started saying that, you know, I think that Lou Harrison had a lot to do with that. But I think Cowell also sort of nurtured Cage's ideas early on, before Cage was writing a great deal of music. You know, Cage's earliest music is not percussion music. you know, it's piano music, it's string music, it's serial, like, or 12 tone. It's, you know, it's not, it wasn't, he didn't jump right into percussion, but percussion right. to him was the democratizing body of instruments, you know, for the world. And in a sense, right. I think it was right. I guess that's what I was getting at, Gary, when I was saying, did either of you feel vindicated by Cage in your interest in percussion, or was it a, was it already in place? You know, was it a, the world that you inhabited when you first began to bang on things? Was Cage already part of that? Did he create that world? That was that already in place for you?
Well, I already I mentioned that my early influencers were Jack McKenzie, my brother Rick, who is older than I am. So before I, you know, I really even read about these things. I had great band teachers and in high school and in elementary school that were fairly progressive. And somehow there was some connection in Illinois to California. I don't know where that came from, but, you know, all this kind of came out of California, right, with Harry Partch. He was in Arizona originally, and Lou Harrison, who
John
I got
Cage.
To work with a bunch of times,
John
and
Cage.
John.
Yeah, and proximity to the Orient, you know. That's
exactly. I think that had a lot to do with it. And Terry Riley, too, of course, later.
Yeah, Terry Riley, of course.
In Chinatown in San Francisco, where they got a lot of Chinese tom-toms and cymbals and those kind of instruments. And I think because Russell pointed out before that they were an incredibly creative lot, I don't think any of them studied percussion in a conservatory. So they played their own music as they could. But, you know, John never wrote for snare drum or timpani, I don't think. So,
there is,
you know,
one piece for snare drum. One.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Solo snare drum. There's
composed
a solo snare
improvisation.
Drum.
Yeah.
In most of his music, there is not a roll. You know, that's something that percussionists do. But, of course, if you're not a percussionist, you don't know how to roll.
Uh-huh.
So
uh-huh.
Most of his music doesn't have that in it.
Yeah. And a lot, I mean, Cage was very fond of handheld percussion. You know, he was, I think, because he created his own ensemble when he didn't have a dime to his name. So they were, I mean, look at living room music, for example, you know,
right.
using
right.
newspapers and books and anything that made sound. And, you know, so he was, I think his invention, in a sense, came out of need.
Right.
Probably
right.
good
right.
that he wasn't taught. You know, that he wasn't a yeah. percussionist, he probably would not have become a percussion composer. Maybe. Who knows? You know, who knows?
You don't know.
He also, as I understand it, didn't do well in school in classes relating to harmony. And there was that big controversy in the 50s that he made some comment about if he's right, Beethoven is wrong. That was totally misunderstood, of course. But I'm glad that he didn't do a big emphasis on harmony, because he really got into other aspects of music that other people right. were not paying attention to, like
that's
rhythm
correct.
And
like rhythm
and yeah. concept of ma, you
yeah.
know, all
yeah.
those things that play an important part in the percussion world.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that was, I mean, that was the famous Schoenberg line to Cage, you know, that if you have no feeling for harmony, you'll just pound your head against a wall. You know, and he said, then I'm going to pound my head against that wall.
That's what he did.
It's one thing that I can say about him with great love and fondness for him is that he was marvelous at figuring out something to do when he hadn't a clue what to do. He was inventive, perhaps like his father, you know, who was an inventor. He would figure out something that he could do, no matter how audacious it might seem to someone more learned, you know, to do something that was so simple or naive, perceived as naive, which led to some miraculous things, you know, his indeterminacy stories. You know, what composer would, you know, sit in front of the Darmstadt group and tell anecdotes about his family and friends, you know? And yet it became, you know, they owned it after about 10 years later. They decided that they were the people who were responsible for John Cage making this piece, you know.
From what I understand, it goes way back in his early years that, you know, Cage was a valedictorian of his high school class.
Yeah.
And his best friend at that time was my oldest brother's father-in-law. And as Kimmis Hendrick, he was the editor-in-chief of the West Coast edition of the Christian Science Monitor. And so he wrote a piece years later, after their high school years, about Cage's speech on graduation day. And he said that Cage was a little nervous about it, that he had written this very traditional speech and then got up on the podium and threw it away and talked about mushrooms for 20 minutes. And he's a high school student, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we all know that he was a real expert in mushrooms, made a big hit in Italy on a TV show. And also there's some story about Takamitsu, who Nexus worked with a lot. They became close friends, and I think they influenced and supported each other's music. But maybe, Russell, you could tell that story about them driving in a car in Northern California through the woods. Are you familiar with that story?
I wasn't there. I don't know. I've heard that story sounds familiar, but I don't think I know enough to be able to tell.
But what I remember of that is that they were being driven from one concert venue to another, and they were going through the Redwood Forest. And Cage all of a sudden shouts to the driver, "Pull over right now." And he pulled over. He said, "What are you going to do?" And he said, "You know, this is the perfect spot for this certain kind of mushroom to grow." And he ran into the woods, turned over a leaf, and there was this mushroom that was very rare. And, you know, this could be one of those hyperboles that gets exaggerated through the years, but I just love that story. And Takamitsu was incredibly impressed.
I'm impressed. You know, Gary, that story you just told about your older brother's father-in-law, and he was the editor of the Christian Science Monitor.
The West Coast editor, yeah.
The West Coast, yeah. But was he a Christian Scientist?
He was, yeah.
Well, the reason I'm asking you this is a very particular reason, and I never knew any connection between Cage and Christian Scientists. But somebody once asked me if John Cage ever told me a joke, and he did once in his whole life, our whole time together. He told me one joke, and I'm going to tell you the joke as quickly as I can because I don't want to use our time really. But the joke, I told him a joke, and he said, "Oh, I have one. And I said, "Okay." And it was a joke about all the religious leaders coming together in a town hall in Boston for their annual meeting. The rabbi was the head of this meeting that particular year, and everyone's settling down into this creaky old wooden structure. And the rabbi sits there, and all of a sudden he gets astonished or kind of grief-stricken look on his face. And he looks around the table and he says, "Is there a Christian Scientist here? Is there a Christian Scientist here?" And of course, the Christian Scientist is across the room, and he stands up very proudly and he says, "Yes, Rabbi, yes, I am a Christian Scientist." And the rabbi says, "Oh, thank God. Can you change places with me? There seems to be a draft."
Wow.
You had a delayed reaction, and I thought, "Oh my God, it's LA all over again." I told this joke at a symposium at the Museum of Contemporary Art, and when I got to the punchline, not one person in the hall laughed, which made me burst out laughing because they obviously didn't know about the Christian Scientist's lack of belief in illness. You know, but that was John Cage's joke.
That's funny. I never heard a joke from Cage either, but I always thought of him as a very funny, amusing, fun-loving person. You know, he had that incredible smile and laugh.
Yeah.
But so, you know, he was always saying funny things, but maybe not telling jokes per se.
I know, that was why it was so remarkable when he said, "I have one." It was like, really? I've never heard him tell a structured kind of story joke, you know?
He was a funny guy.
He was a funny guy. I think when I think about his humor, though, the thing that I think about, maybe it's what you mean, Gary, what you just said, that he would be quiet. And then all of a sudden, he would enter the conversation with some remarkably funny statement and right in line with the conversation that he would say, you know, I don't know, he would just say something incredibly funny. I thought he was to be around.
He would. I spent an evening with him actually in Toronto. We were doing a recording session of Ryōan-ji, and the version for a flute and percussion. And we were at a recording studio in a person's house, and they were having trouble with the recording equipment. So Cage and I just went into another room and sat there and talked for, I don't know, an hour or two until they got the equipment fixed. And he was telling me all kinds of stories. So he told me the story about, he said he had arthritis very badly at one point. He couldn't even write. It was so bad. And then he said his friend, John Lennon, told him he should go on a macrobiotic diet, which he did. And he said it cured it completely.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he said to me, in, you know, his kind of wry humor, but don't do it unless you actually have to.
I remember David.
He hated the diet, but he did.
I don't know if he hated the diet. I think that's unfair. But I have to tell you, one time I was talking with David Vaughn, who was the archivist for Cunningham forever. David died a few years ago now, 3 years ago, I think. But anyway, David, when I was working with Cage, I was so excited about this macrobiotic diet, and Cage was teaching me everything he knew. And I was talking to David one day in his office, and I said, you really should come to lunch sometime. And he said, oh, I don't know. And I said, David, you know, John is an incredible macrobiotic cook, and you should try these recipes. And he says, very dismissive, he said, oh, Laura, you never had his Coco Van. So Cage was a real lover of decadence. You know, he loved chain smoked. Yeah. He loved to drink. You know, he loved butter and cream and all that. You know,
but he didn't like yogurt or spinach, right? Because it wasn't part of the. He didn't like spinach or yogurt because it wasn't part of the macrobiotic diet.
Spinach is hard on the joints, apparently, according to macrobiotic theory. So you should eat other leafy greens, but not spinach because of the alkaline or something is in it.
That eliminates a lot of great South Indian dishes that we love.
Totally.
Well, speaking of that, Cage, in the same evening of conversation, he said to me that he was in India once. And I guess he was in a macrobiotic diet by then. And the first day he went up to somebody and said, is there a health food restaurant nearby? And the person looked to him and said, the whole country's a health food restaurant.
That's very, very funny. He loved, as I said, cream and butter and things like that. And one year he bought an ice cream maker, a Sumac, one of those fancy $300, you know, electric ice cream makers, which he then taught himself how to make ice cream using tofu and bananas. And he bought these ice cream. I still have my ice cream maker. I don't use it, but he bought it for everybody around him. He bought a spare that he kept in the closet because he couldn't stand the idea that it would break down and he would be without it. And he would make his version of ice cream, you know, every single day. We are almost out of time. We have about 2 minutes. Do you guys want to say anything about dance music for Alfred Ide? Because we're going to play a little bit of that more. We played a little bit at the start. We played the first movement, and we're going to play both of the versions of your third movement, the one for piano and the one for mallet instruments. Do you have anything you want to say about that piece? You came to that.
Well, Laura,
one.
We have to give you credit for making us aware of that piece. As I understand it, didn't you discover it in some desk in Mills College or something?
In Mills College. It was on the shelf, actually. It was just stuck on the shelf. It was among many of the students' sort of thesis project binders.
It hadn't been performed since that graduate recital of Ilfred's, right, that she danced to it, right?
Yeah.
So it was a really wonderful piece for us. We melted it down to five players. I think it really required seven, or depending on exactly who played what, but it was really fun putting that together. And boy, that first movement is tricky. It really rips along in tempo. The rhythms and all that are just amazing. And you know, I think some people see that as his fourth construction, right? Because it does follow, and maybe it was the real third one. I don't know what the order turns out to be, but it really is. It has a lot of connection to the constructions. Second movement, when we performed that up in Toronto, I remember people started laughing when I came in on the toy piano part, because it's so playful and a lot of toy stuff. And also there's like a party honker in there and a twirling thing. And it's really, really wonderful stuff. And, you know, he didn't, I think, care if people found these things to be silly. This is exactly what he wanted, and he got it.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, he once told me that he thought the toy piano was the most heroic of instruments.
Wow.
That's what I did, Russell. I burst out laughing. It was such a funny thing to say, but so in some respects, so true. When I listen to his Suite for Toy Piano, I smile because I think it's absolutely this little instrument doing this noble piece, you know, playing this very noble piece. Anyway.
Lucky for us, he never lost a child inside of himself. So that's what we got.
Absolutely true. It's true. Up to his death, even. He was very funny. All right, you guys. Anything upcoming that you wanna talk about? That's our timer. That's a little timer saying, "Hey, stop talking."
I'm looking forward to getting the vaccine. So that's the one thing.
You and me both. Anybody got it on their schedule? Anybody have?
Not yet. Yeah. I haven't heard. I mean, I should be in one of the high priority groups. I'm old enough, but they're starting at age 80 in Canada, 80 and over.
Yeah.
I think some
of the states are doing 80 as well.
Yeah.
But I don't even think they're there yet. I'm not sure.
No, I haven't heard. It's still frontline workers and that sort of thing here.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for
this is great.
No,
it's fun to talk about him.
It is fun to talk about him. I would love to do a show in the near future about Cage and Takemitsu. So
that would be great.
If you'd be interested, because it's not a subject I know much about, but there's a great deal of interest in the two of them together.
Yep, that would be great. Let's do that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good luck with your shoulder. We'll be thinking.
Thank you so much. Getting it fixed next week.
Exactly.
What's wrong with your shoulder?
I'm getting the rotator cuff sewn up on the other arm. I had the other one done a couple years ago, and it worked out great. I can do all that. Maybe we'll play tennis again soon, Russell.
Good. Well, don't get COVID.
Is that an artifact of your work, of your occupation?
That and hearing loss. yeah, it all goes hand in hand.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Laura. See you guys.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Now on to a bit more of dance music for Alfred Eide. This work was composed when Cage was in residence at Mills College in the 1930s, but was only rediscovered to be extant in 2006 within the holdings of the Mills College Music Library. It was subsequently edited and prepared for publication by the late Don Gillespie, a longtime employee at C.F. Peters, Cage's publisher in New York. Cage composed this work for the dancer Alfred Eide, whose lifespan was 1917 to 1993. She was the daughter of the New England composer and teacher Chester Eide, who lived 1878 to 1944, who was also a composer, primarily of operettas, and likely first performed on her thesis dance concert at Mills. I titled her choreography Wheel of Circumstance, its three movements Quest, The Rift Between, and Song in Counterpoint. The work was scored for percussion sextet, and its instrumentation was elaborate. The three movements were simply titled number one, Fast, number two, Without Title, and number three, With Spirit. The instruments are hand clap, block, six tom-toms, clavis, cowbells, and rattle for the first movement, toy piano, muted gongs, slide whistle, cymbal, bass drum, low tom-tom, and ratchet for the second movement, and piano, clavis, and slapstick for the third movement. We listen to the first movement of dance music for Alfred Eide, number one, Fast, at the top of this program, and now let's listen to back-to-back renditions of its third movement, three, With Spirit. First in its original instrumentation for piano, clavis, and slapstick, followed by an arrangement made by Gary Kvistad for mallet instruments, which was created for ease in touring the work when only the percussion ensemble was in attendance. Nexus was joined in this recording by the pianist Lydia Wong.